had a project in mind that I wanted you to look at a couple, 3 weeks ago, and I forgot to mention it to you. But in Ezekiel chapter 28, in verses 25 and 26, now this talks about Zidon, which is going to be, which God is telling Ezekiel is going to be destroyed and so forth. But in verse 25 and 26, it says, "Thus says the Lord God, when I gather the house of Israel from the peoples among whom they are scattered, and manifest my holiness in them in the sight of the nations, then they shall dwell in their own land, which I gave to my servant Jacob, and they shall dwell securely in it, and they shall build houses and plant vineyards. They shall dwell securely when I execute judgments upon all their neighbors who have treated them with contempt. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God." So think about those two verses, study them some, and the next week we'll visit with it just a little bit and talk about the meaning of those two verses. Tonight we're going to be studying chapters 29 through 32. And these chapters have six prophecies that are given at various times, and they're not in chronological order as far as when the prophecies were given, although they're in chronological order as far as chapters 29 to 32 are concerned. The first prophecy comes during the siege of Ezekiel. And we find this in chapters 29, verse 1. And this is a prophecy that comes during the siege of Jerusalem. It's not been defeated as yet, but it's about the time that Pharaoh's army is coming to rescue Jerusalem. If you'll remember, Ed, that we, when we studied a few chapters back, that Zedekiah had been appointed by Nebuchadnezzar to rule Judah, and he swore an oath to Babylon, and then went, he was a little treacherous there, went behind his back, contacted the Egyptians, and secured a promise for help. And I think this was one of the reasons, I think I mentioned this a number of times, is the order, Judah came first, Jerusalem came first, when the Babylonians decided to take that area. They were not happy at all about what had happened. So I remember any time in sieges are done against cities or states, they come up, they don't have the modern weapons that we have today, of course, and so they construct battering rams, and they start piling up dirt and rocks and whatnot up against the walls. They burn the gates. They do everything they can to breach the walls. And of course, this takes a long time. In fact, took several years for Nebuchadnezzar to breach the walls of Jerusalem. And look back at Tyre, took him 13 years to do that. So, kind of gives you a little bit of a picture of just how long these things take, and there's got to be a vast expense for the armies to be there and do this type of thing. When Egypt started out to help, remember we studied about this in Jeremiah, the Chaldeans left off the besieging of Jerusalem and went to fight the Egyptians. And so gave the people of Jerusalem a little respite there, but they're going to come back. So when the Egyptians confronted the Babylonians, they withdrew. And then, of course, Babylon came right back and returned to besieging Jerusalem. Remember in Jeremiah 37, the Lord told Ezekiel that you tell Zedekiah that even if the Babylonians returned and only had wounded to fight Jerusalem, they'd still burn the city with fire. And all kings, by the way, and that ruled Egypt were called pharaohs. And this guy's name was Hophra. And he ruled Egypt for 25 years. He went to help put down a rebellion in Libya. His army turned against him, and one of his generals, a man named Amasis, strangled him and took over the throne. Nebuchadnezzar was at war with Egypt at this time. He was banging heads with them down that way and kind of keeping the pressure on them, even though he was not, the bulk of his army was working on Jerusalem and on Tyre. So, but he was putting pressure on Egypt at that particular time, and I think he supported the overthrow of this Egyptian general, and probably in exchange for an oath of loyalty to Babylon. But during this time, Jeremiah was in Egypt, along with the Israelites who had left Jerusalem. If you'll remember, we studied back in Jeremiah that Jeremiah ended up in Egypt and built a wall with stones, and God said, well, yeah, I build this wall with stones here, and this is where Nebuchadnezzar is going to set up his thrones. So Jeremiah is there in Egypt. This Hophra was also called a great water monster. Various commentators I ran across use the word crocodile because they can't believe that there existed dinosaurs or anything like that back in those days. So a crocodile was a symbol of Egypt in Roman times, and so they picked this up. The old King James Version refers to him as uses dragons and whales. But Pharaoh Hophra's main fault, of course, and here it comes back one more time, is his pride. He believes his kingdom exists by his power. In essence, he believes himself a god of some importance. But God says he'll put a hook in his mouth and control him, and fish will stick to his scales. The Egyptians would, what basically that means is the Egyptians will stick to him, and then they'll end up suffering the same fate that he's going to suffer. Kind of a question here is, do we see a common thread in the demise of all of these countries? Down the road, it's going to happen to Babylon as well, but now God is using them to carry out his will. on all the surrounding countries. Is this a problem we see in today's world? And be sure and unmute if you have something to say.
Ron, I think I'm convinced that we don't see these national promises anymore. The promise today has been transformed. Now we have the promise in the church and in individuals, but the promise that involves nations, I think that has been done away. That's just my impression. I think many times the same philosophies that characterize these countries of old characterize countries today, and it produces the same thing. But I don't know I have not seen that it's necessarily God producing this as much as it's the same characteristic philosophy that, you know, we're so great and we're, you know, all that we can be, and that causes countries to fall. Just righteousness exalts a nation. Wickedness causes it to fall.
It's the same even in our personal lives. When we have pride, you can be pride in your accomplishments. There's nothing wrong with being happy or being proud of accomplishments or something you've done on a personal level. But then I think it becomes so overwhelming at times that it just, you know, what is it? What's the saying? Pride becomes comes before a fall. And when something like this happens, you know, it's just all consuming, and that's what has happened to these people. I was thrilled to death and proud of all the efforts that the Ducks made this last weekend. I was really disgusted with USC, but thought I'd get that dig in there, Dean.
Watch it. God always gets even.
But anyway, I was really proud of the effort that the Ducks showed last Saturday. But, you know, I've seen this before when they have become so proud, stuck on themselves, the next game they end up losing and they're embarrassed. But their pride got in their way. I've seen that happen several times to the Ducks. So I'm hoping that they'll stay down to earth and realize that, yeah, they can have pride in the hard work that they've done. Just don't let it get consuming and end up falling over.
Ron?
Yes, go.
I think that one of the things that is so detrimental to pride is that you are relying so much on yourself and your opinion of yourself that you don't take anybody else's into consideration. Lindbergh, when he flew over to Germany, was fooled by the Germans because they flew him from one airport to another airport to another airport, and they flew the planes all around and fooled him. And he came back and he said, oh, we can't beat them. And by the time he finally humbled himself and figured out that he'd been fooled, he couldn't get anybody to believe that he could be for the government, you know.
Well, he was pretty loud mouth about being a pacifist and didn't want, he supported, I think, the Germans to begin with, but he eventually went over to the Pacific and actually flew a combat mission, even though he was a civilian, and actually shot down a Japanese plane. So, I think he kind of had a rude awakening, but I don't know if he was a pacifist for the rest of his life. I just don't know that. But he started out that way. But when Pharaoh falls, like God predicted, the people of Egypt would understand that God is in control. And Pharaoh is depicted as a walking stick, weak, and not worth a whole lot. 2 Kings 18 calls Egypt a broken reed that will pierce any who leans on it. And this, of course, is referring to Israel and Zedekiah's treachery. We'll find when Nebuchadnezzar goes down into Egypt and takes Egypt, that all the countries that are around there are going to end up suffering along with Egypt, simply because they were looking to Egypt for protection. God says that Egypt will suffer for 40 years. And this Amasis, who killed Hophra, he ruled for 40 years. And but it was a shattered country after Nebuchadnezzar got through with it, until Cyrus came to power. And Egypt's people as a nation would be scattered, and Egypt's power gone even after Cyrus came to power. And it would be a conquered nation and of succeeding empires for the next couple of thousand years. So we had Nebuchadnezzar coming in, and he's going to destroy it, and then the Medes and the Persians are going to come to power, and if you remember, Assyria took them on, and before the Babylonians, and then there were a procession of various powers that came along and kept Egypt subdued, and since then they just have never been a world power anymore. And excuse me. And so, honey, would you get me a glass of water?
Yeah,
thank you. So you remember, of course, when the most recent world power that we read of is mentioned in the New Testament, and that's Rome, which ruled the world at that particular time, and of course they ruled that area of the world as well. The next prophecy comes 17 years later, and by the dates we have, and that's really one thing that's interesting about Ezekiel, is he gives specific dates for a lot of stuff. And this second prophecy we find, and that is in Ezekiel 29, starts in 17. It's 17 years later after this first one. And by its date, it's the last prophecy we know of written by Ezekiel. And after the destruction of Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar spent two or three campaigns in conquest of the Ammonites and the Moabites, and making himself master of those countries. These were the people that he put on the back burner, actually had them assist him in defeating Jerusalem and Judah. If you remember, right, there was Gedaliah, I think that's right, we talked about in Jeremiah, I believe it was Gedaliah, that Nebuchadnezzar appointed him as a governor after Zedekiah was taken. And the Ammonites conspired with one another and assassinated him. And I'm sure that this was probably one of the reasons that Babylon decided they were going to clean clock with these people east of the Jordan River. And Nebuchadnezzar set up the Arabs to assist him in doing that. And the Arabs came through and defeated the Ammonites in Moab. But after the destruction of these people, he spent 13 years besieging Tyre and Sidon. And during that time, Egypt was involved in various wars and rebellions and had expended a lot of their assets, a lot of their power, and found themselves weak. And just at the end of Tyre, God delivers this prophecy to Ezekiel to signify the destruction of Egypt, which he had foretold 15 years before. In Jeremiah 43 and 44, God condemns all those who fled Jerusalem and went to live in Egypt. And if you'll remember that, this is when they didn't believe Jeremiah. And a lot of them took off and went to Egypt for protection. And God is going to condemn all those. And you know, this just happened to be, and Jeremiah was taken along, I think, against his wishes, but he was taken anyway. And I don't know what happened to Jeremiah when he was in Egypt. A number of people think that he lost his life down in that area as well. But I don't know for sure. But they went to live in Egypt for protection. But the problem is they had continued their evil practices, and they refused to listen to Jeremiah when he told them they would be destroyed along with the Egyptians when the Babylonians came. And they said, well, we don't believe you. We don't think this is going to happen. And they continued their idol worships and all the evils that they had done in Judah. They practiced in Egypt as well. So their end is going to come when Nebuchadnezzar shows up. So Tyre has now been defeated. But because it took so long, the people of Tyre had been successful in removing much of their wealth, and Nebuchadnezzar did not realize enough gain to pay his army. And armies back then were made up of a lot of mercenaries. It was the only way that a lot of people could make a living, the armies, warriors. And so they came to these various countries, Babylon. We saw that there were, Tyre had a bunch of people, and it's mentioned in chapter 27, I believe. About all the, or chapter 28, all the people that hung their shields, on the walls in Tyre. And so there were a lot of, and this happened too as far as Egypt was concerned, and the Babylonians are no different. So the Babylonians took Tyre, but they didn't realize any money out of it, not enough at least to pay wages for his army. So God gives Egypt and all the wealth there to the Babylonians as compensation for their loss of wages in Tyre. And they went through and they ravaged the land from north to south. And a lot of the border countries, like Ethiopia, for instance, became subservient to Babylon as well. Mainly because Ethiopia, they sent warriors up to help Egypt. And of course, they were killed along with all the other army. And so they felt like they were subdued. They couldn't depend, of course, on Egypt anymore. So they became subservient to Babylon. The water sources that we read about, the canal watering system, would dry up in Egypt, and the farmland would become wasteland. And this was one of the downfalls of Hophra, because he went in there and he dug canals and to water the land. Of course, most of that land down in there is, except along a river, is desert country anyway. And but he had made canals, and he was really proud of his accomplishments there. But I don't know if there was a famine and the rains didn't come, and so the river receded and couldn't fill the canals up. I don't know, but anyway, the canals, the watering systems dried up and everything became wasteland. And then the third prophecy that takes place about 3 months before the fall of Jerusalem, Ezekiel 30. And this is about the time Egypt attempted to lift the siege against Jerusalem. And Jeremiah describes this in chapter 37. Jeremiah 46 and chapter 24 of 2 Kings tells us that the power of Egypt was broken and there would be no healing of it. It says a broken arm cannot wield a sword, and Egypt will no longer have an army to employ. Breaking both arms said there will be no alternative. You don't have a choice. Egypt will be sent into captivity. At least those that survive the sword, the pestilence, and the famine. And of course, through weakening Egypt, God is making more powerful the Babylonians. The fourth prophecy that we have comes in the 11th year of in Ezekiel 31:1, and this prophecy takes place 1 month before Jerusalem falls and gives him some lessons from Assyria. And Jerusalem is about to fall, and rather than rejoice, Egypt should realize that it can and will, for that matter, fall. And a comparison is made to another mighty nation, a nation of Assyria. And of course, they're gone now. This is a nation that was compared to the cedars of Lebanon. And Assyria was mighty and tall and above all others. It was their waters that made them great. And I think that this, referring to their waters, probably refers to its people. Their channels refer to their colonies that sent back resources to their home city. They had all kinds of riches to tap. says the birds rested in the branches. Other nations benefited from its protection. Other nations rested under the shade of the trees. No other nation could match its strength and its beauty. And God made Assyria for what it was, and it made other nations jealous. But because of its greatness, Assyria, here again, became proud of its accomplishments and didn't give God the credit, so God gave it over to another mighty nation, and that was Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar, in his first year of his reign, defeated Assyria. And in Daniel refers to him in Daniel chapter 2 as he is referred to as God's representative. And Assyria became a place to plunder, and nothing was left. It at one time was the greatest nation in the world, but now it has come to ruin. And people who once benefited from it and closely related to Assyria took off, and they got away as quickly as they possibly could for fear of Babylon. But its fall was to serve as a warning to all the rulers that had become so prideful, and let them realize that they could fall in the same manner. When Assyria fell, the recourse is dried up, and this, of course, caused those around it to mourn in passing. But a country so great like Assyria was, and we see it even today when a great country falls, it causes a major impact in the world. You look at Britain, for instance. Before World War II, they just about ruled everything. They were probably the mightiest nation on earth. They had far-flung enterprises everywhere. India, all up and down that area in the east, controlled by Britain. But look what happened after World War II. All these countries became independent, and they didn't want anything to do with Britain anymore, and their colonialism was over. And so it had a tremendous impact on the power and the influence of Britain. Other nations the same way. Prior to World War II, Italy was a powerful nation. They disappeared. And even when Germany was defeated, it just left an impact that is, the effects of it are happening today. So you can see what happens nowadays, even as it did back in those days. When weaker nations around Assyria, they see a fall like that, then they get fearful, and they know, hey, this could happen to us as well. So although the lesser nations probably felt a little bit more confident when they had the big bully was removed, Assyria's allies went by the wayside when it was destroyed. And what this is saying is, look at Assyria and what God did to them. Egypt is not Assyria's equal. Egypt is not invincible. It's going to fall. And, of course, we know that this is what happened. The fifth prophecy takes place in the 12th year, and this is Ezekiel 32, 1 through 16. And at the time of this prophecy, Jerusalem is gone. It's been taken. Everybody who wasn't killed has been shipped off. The city has been burned. The city has been totally looted. Everything has gone to Babylon. Zedekiah has had his eyes put out. He's been captured and had his eyes put out. We know the story about that. And Amasis, who strangled Pharaoh Hophra and took over, has started his revolt against the Pharaoh, and who was a troublemaker. And he kept troubling the nations around him, but he fouled up, muddied the waters of his own country. And just like a dangerous animal that's hunted down, Pharaoh is going to be caught in a net. And God will use various nations against him. God predicted that he would die in an open field. It happened in Libya when he was there helping his friend, the Libyan king, against a rebellion that was going on there. And says he'll be eaten by birds of prey. So the buzzards got him out in, along with his massive slaughter of his army. They would all die out there in the desert. And we're told that Egypt's light would be put out, and the nation and government would be removed. And as word gets out about Egypt's destruction and captivity, the other nations will fear, even those that don't have any connection with Egypt. God's sword is mentioned here, and that refers to Nebuchadnezzar. And there's just not another powerful nation around that to challenge the Babylonians. He's the cat's meow. And he's going to rule the world for a while, and until he ends up with pride. And so God brings him down for a while. And eventually, Babylon is going to be destroyed because of it. But I think I mentioned it before several weeks back about his growing long fingernails and long hair and eating grass. So kind of lost his mind for a while. But there's just not another powerful nation that's able to take him on. So Jeremiah in the 46th chapter describes God and his giving Egypt over to him, and their people will die, their wealth will be plundered, their land will be so empty that nothing remains, the land would become so desolate, and then because of this, they would realize that God controls it all. Really a sad consequence for a once great nation, and they were there for many, many thousands of years. The sixth prophecy that we have takes place in the 12th year, 2 weeks after the fifth prophecy. It's Ezekiel 32. And it describes a lament for the people of Egypt. The imagery is a funeral where the people of Egypt are represented by the body about to be buried. And Ezekiel is told to take up a wail, as people sometimes do at a funeral. The burial takes place where other nations have been buried. And Egypt's beauty will not spare her the same fate as these other Gentile nations. Someone once said that a beautifully embalmed body is still just as dead. And the kingdom is going to be destroyed. It's going to die by the sword, be dragged unwillingly to the grave. The place of the uncircumcised is a place of contempt. And Egypt is there greeted by the strong and their allies who have died before. And that would be Assyria and her allies. It says they're slain and they're in the pits. That talks about Elam, who was fierce and prideful. They're now dead. Edom is now dead. Tyre and Sidon, all of those people are dead. And it says Pharaoh will see all these people who were once proud and powerful and will find some comfort in that they're with him in the grave. So I wonder if this talks about any consciousness after the grave. I don't know. It'd be kind of interesting to talk about. But that's about all I have this evening. And has anybody got any comments or questions, anything like that?
Ron, I find it interesting. I think what's happening here is God is just laying out the future. And unlike some prophecies, there's nothing that you can do to stop this. This is what's going to happen. So I see this as there are kind of two kinds of prophecy. Prophecy that just is a warning. If you don't repent and turn back to God, you're going to be destroyed. And then there's the prophecy that goes, this is what's going to happen, and there's nothing that you can do to stop it. This is what a lot of people call apocalyptic prophecy, where God is just laying out the course of history before it happens. I think there, you know, you get the second half of Ezekiel, parts of Daniel. I think the book of Revelation is the same thing. God is just laying out what's going to happen. And it's encouraging to us to know that God is sovereign, that God is in charge. In spite of what these different nations thought, God is still in charge. God is calling the shots.
I think, you know, of all the, and thank you, Dean, that's exactly right. But, you know, God gave the children of Israel every generation an opportunity to return to their proper place in history. And they just have, it's fascinating to me that you go back all the way back. I can remember it was Isaac's wife when Abraham sent to his servant to Haran to find a wife for Isaac, and she had idols. And of course, Haran was, you know, was in what was that? That'd be Iraq today, but you know, it was a heathen nation, and then even when Jacob went to work for his wives. She grabbed up all the idols and took off with them and was sitting on them, you know, hiding. And you just go, it starts way back there. I'm sure they had idols way back before Noah as well, but even so, it just is the entire world, through the Old Testament was dealing with idols and, one type or another. They just couldn't get over, the fact that God was in control. They just couldn't get it. And for a while here and there, they were good. And then they just reverted right back to where they were before. And so God's just, you know, he's still giving them a chance. He has given them a chance. And now, you know, all of these other countries too had opportunities, but they just practiced evil to the point where God was going to take care of them. And none of these countries, Babylon's gone, Assyria's gone, Egypt, a little weak country, third world country, most of the Edom, Moab, Ammonites, Ammon, all gone. And just like God predicted. So anyway, anybody else have any comments before we quit tonight? Think about that last two verses, 25 and 26 in chapter 28. We'll kind of look at that next week if we have an opportunity, and we'll go from there. And then in chapter 33, we'll start in that one. That's a kind of a change of pace. And all the countries that God has predicted destruction for is going to be gone here, and God gets back and gets the attention of Ezekiel.